Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. Now, listen, it gives me no pleasure to tell you this, right? So, and block your ears if you don't want to hear it. But the front of the Sunday Independent said safety fears threat to schools staying open. And I know some of you already have your fingers in your ears going, la, 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 don't want to hear it. You would hope, though, that it's kind of a brinksmanship, and that would, so like the first line is, there are major doubts among teachers and principals that schools can remain open after Halloween, pause, without improved support from the HSE. So hopefully this is just that they are looking for improved support from the HSE, and hopefully they will get it. As we know, the HSE are talking about these dedicated school teams coming in. There's also a poll in the Sunday Independent. 42% are hugely concerned by the virus, which is back up to where the numbers were at kind of much earlier in the year. But one in four is still prepared to consider breaking whatever rules are in place to visit family around the country over Christmas. That would be the same one in four that are already breaking the rules on a regular basis, I'd say. But anyway, the Sunday Times, NPHET considers, quotes, unreliable rapid tests for schools. Look, the schools want rapid testing, and you got to think they're right as well. And it would seem that the obvious answer to that is the antigen tests, which they've been testing. And if there's one that's reasonably reliable, you would think that would make more sense. There's good news buried in this front page story on the Sunday Times. So the November 19th review of the current level 5 restrictions could result in the 5km travel limit being raised to 10 kilometres, hallelujah. The reopening of golf and tennis clubs as well as gyms. Is that really all they're going to give us if we're behaving ourselves, as they say, up to then? Is that all we're going to get? The Business Post. This is interesting. Silent majority backs lockdown as hopes rise for early vaccine. So 66% of people support the move to lockdown the country, with just 18% opposed. There's a slight caveat there in that what was proposed to people in this poll was a circuit breaker for 2 to 3 weeks. So I think a lot of people have a very clean idea in their heads of a circuit breaker. We take a little break for 2 weeks and we'll be back then. But still, that's an interesting number. And support and opposition to fines broke down roughly the same way. There's a good sidebar there. Leo Varadkar believes it will be a kind of poetry when he becomes Taoiseach again on the 100th anniversary of the foundation of the state. The Irish Mail on Sunday, GP warning we're facing collapse next. And GPs and out-of-hours practices are on the brink of collapse, and talking there about burnout among GPs. And you can well imagine at this stage that your bounce back ability has got to be suffering if you're a GP facing into winter surge again. The Sunday World, Spanish cops bug Gilligan, and his girlfriend was also lifted in the raid, they tell us here. And The Sun on Sunday is Thug's Garden Secret, Gilligan gun like a grizzly trophy. And the Mirror has, so you know, you're familiar with the Shebeen with the 70-inch television and the pool table. So the footage has emerged of a lockdown hoedown in the in said Shebeen. But it was rated as, quotes, party patrol Gardaí launched a bank holiday crackdown. So there you go. Our panel today, Gary Murphy is head of the School of Law and Government at DCU. Dominic Kemp is a chef and an author and a businesswoman. And Sarah Ann Buckley is a historian and a lecturer in NUIG and president of the Women's History Association of Ireland. And don't panic, Sarah Ann Buckley is socially distanced from us in a different studio. So we're not packing them in here. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Brendan. Morning, Brendan.
That's an interesting finding there, Domini, isn't it? About 66% of people want a lockdown. And I think the suggestion is made that people in your industry and other industries affected, that everyone feels very sorry for you, but that you and the likes of the Vintners and stuff have skewed the national conversation in such a way that you would think that, you know, 2/3 of the people don't want a lockdown.
Yeah, I also think it's important, though. I think a lot of the people that were polled are of an older generation, older demographic. And we also have to remember that half the economy is unaffected by lockdown. We are disproportionately being punished by the lockdown in terms of hospitality and travel and so on. So it is really unfortunate And I think that restaurants, we've been pretty much locked down since September the 18th. Unless you had significant outdoor space in order to carry on.
Which are no matter how significant your outside space, you were only allowed 15 people there anyway, weren't you?
That's exactly it. And I think, you know, the frustration is a lot of controls were put in place since June, since we reopened after the initial lockdown. It was quite a controlled space. Of course, there were examples that you could see on social media of rule breaking going on. But in general, the vast majority were a very regulated sector anyway. And really, customers tend to, you know, they vote with their feet. If they saw somewhere that wasn't operating safely, they just didn't go in. So I think the real frustration is we're still waiting on the evidence, international evidence, to show how restaurants have really contributed to the spread.
OK, Gary, what do you make of that? Is the elite out of touch with the groundswell of people here who want the place locked down and want safety at all costs?
Well, I think it depends what you mean by elite. I mean, I often laugh when people think politicians are somehow differently removed, and maybe they are to an extent in their bubble in Leinster House, but they are our peers to an extent. And we see today in the Mail a big story about a growing revolt in rural Ireland over level 5 impositions led by that old dog, and that's the quote in the paper, Michael Ring. And I do think there is a difficulty in rural Ireland. There is clearly a difficulty in the hospitality sector, but even in the sporting sector. I mean, for the life of me, you know, I don't play golf, but I can't understand why golf clubs who seem to have done everything right, you know, and I think it's impossible to play golf without being socially distant. Tennis, the same. And this one-size-fits-all, I think, is certainly wearing on people. And I'm not convinced the public will support it if we get into rolling lockdowns.
That poll looks as if they're supporting it for now, or the idea of a circuit breaker.
But I mean, clearly anyone who saw Philip Nolan, the president of Minute and one of Neffet's chief spokespeople, and the graphs he put online, couldn't but be worried about the spread of the virus. It's a very interesting graph from where we were in August. I mean, when many of us holidayed in Ireland, and it was, you know, the virus wasn't defeated, but the levels were very low, to see where they are now, which is, you know, it's out of control, and if it's not stamped down on them, then the big worry is, will the hospitals be overstretched come, and we know hospitals are busy in November, December, January anyway. Like, we've been on this programme loads of times over the winter talking about the crisis in the health service without COVID. So I think that remains the big fear.
Sarah-Anne, you're socially distanced out there in rural Ireland. Where are you living exactly?
I'm living in Clare, in Quilty, near Spanish Point. So I have obviously sympathy for Dominique and all the restaurants. It's the one, I suppose, activity I would do quite a lot, which is eating out. But I think, unfortunately, we've taken suppression as our way forward. And if the message is too complicated, I think that we're just going to see what happened in the summer, which is the numbers growing. And I think they're just the government. There has to be adequate supports for these businesses. These are being affected far, as Dominique has said, they're being affected in a greater way. And we have to support them through this. We don't want to see these businesses close in 2021. We need them supported.
Is the lockdown more difficult in rural Ireland? Like, I saw a quote from, I think it was Michael Fitzmaurice or somebody today, saying that you can get what you want within 5 kilometres in Dublin, but that 5 kilometres down the country is a very different prospect.
Well, where we are, we're lucky. We're not far from a town and from, you know, a super value. But what I will say is there are a number of people that 5 kilometres is nowhere for them. And of course it's different. But again, I think this question of the message, if we overcomplicate the message, what will that lead to? One thing I will say about living in rural Ireland at this time is it has obviously been amazing to get to a beach, to get the positives from that. So I think on one way, rural Ireland has that benefit, at least for us it does.
Yeah, if you're lucky with your 5 kilometre radius, yeah. I suppose. Dominique, Luke O'Neill is writing in the Sunday Independent today, and he conjures the alarming notion that really Christmas is probably cancelled as well. We can't all, you know, have some idea in their heads that we can get back out there for a few weeks of Christmas like we did in the summer. But we saw what happened when we did it in the summer. So in terms of hospitality, presumably like even level three for December is not tenable, is it?
It's not. And I think that was when we heard that we were going to lock down for a 6-week period. I think we were all under the impression that we could get back open for Christmas. And then when you started looking at the fine print, no, it was back to level three. So again, it goes back to this point that restaurants really probably won't be open before Christmas. So we're looking at 2021. A lot of businesses just won't continue to go the distance, because if we're talking about a strategy of rolling lockdowns, that is just untenable, I think.
Okay, so what's the alternative?
So I think a lot of places are going to shutter, you know, if they don't have a viable option to pivot their business and to take away or to get involved in a different form of hospitality, I think businesses will shutter. And I don't think we can come back from that. And although, yes, businesses...
So what would you like to see?
What I'd like to see is a better strategy, because I think the frustration is with the back and forth and the to-ing and fro-ing. When you look at the media reports, it is all doom and gloom, and certainly cases have been rising. But, you know, deaths seem to be low. ICU numbers seem to be low. There seems to be very good control, and certainly in the way that the...
For now.
But we also have to remember that nearly every year there's a trolley crisis. Every year there are deaths from flu. 2,500 people died from pneumonia in 2017-18. This isn't sort of an Ebola outbreak. This is something that is serious. It targets very specific vulnerable groups. But at the same time, the measures that have been imposed and the cost and the destruction to the whole economy, I do really worry that in a few years we'll look back and think that the measures put in place were far too strong.
And how do you think our children will judge us, Gary?
I think they could judge us quite seriously if we don't get a grip of it. I mean, I wanted to do the point I was just about to make there to Domini is that I'm not sure what recovery looks like if a restaurant shuts in where Sarah Ann is, or, you know, in the suburbs where I live. You know, why would it open again? If it could it open again, given the, I presume those even on level three are operating at a loss, or pretty much a loss. Anyway, as regards children, I mean, there's a very good piece of today in the Business Post by Colin Murphy talking about those in their early 20s and, you know, those who might be looking for love. Their whole social life has been shut down. I mean, I think it's important to keep the schools open, certainly, and I would be very worried reading the front pages of some of the newspapers today about the difficulties there and the potential of schools not reopening. I have a son in leaving cert who's, you know, trying to just getting on with it, and those elder teenagers I know from my children's social circles, they're coping now. They're middle class, I think, which helps certainly, and so they have access to the internet and they have access to certain support. I'd be worried for people in less advantaged circumstances, certainly. And I think the government needs to get a handle on that, because that's a big question. I don't think the Neffet modellers had the answer to it too, and I think we need to come up with an answer.
Sarah Ann?
Well, I don't think Neffet are meant to have the answer to policy questions. I think they're telling us how to suppress the virus, and unfortunately,
we don't have so much notice of them, you know, that there's no policy coming forward.
We don't have the ICU capacity. I'm married to a nurse, and I'm telling you, we don't have the ICU capacity. And, you know, we can't deny we underfunded, as we know, Gary, we underfunded very important systems for many years, and this is the effects of it. So that, to me, unfortunately... it's just in my opinion that the public health advice, but obviously everyone in the country has an opinion on this.
How is your husband getting on, Sarah Ann? What kind of a setup is he working in?
But it's a residential setting, so it's fine if the virus is not in there. If it is, it's another situation, obviously. So,
and is he being very careful about how he lives his life?
Well, he is. Level three to me is level five in many ways.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people have been living level five in some ways for the past few months. And it's not, we shouldn't be pointing fingers at anyone. That's not how this should go. But there are obviously a spectrum of views on this. And it's very contentious.
You teach young people as well, don't you?
Yes, I'm a lecturer in the Department of History, so I'm the head of first year at the moment. And
yeah. How are they getting on?
Well, they're getting on, I think, as I hope, as other people. They've been agile. They have been very accommodating. They have issues, obviously, and we're doing our best. But the only safe way to teach 270 students was online. They now have tutorials online, small group teaching. So academics are doing their best, and we are reaching out very regularly. And, you know, our young people are very resilient, is what I would say, in my opinion.
But they're on Zoom. Like, I teach first year, exactly. And it's you're speaking into a computer and the students are speaking back to you. It's no way to teach in one way, but it's also, you know, it's not like when we were in college. There's more to college life than simply sitting into lectures listening to people.
No, no,
like
we
us.
Can't take care of that side, obviously.
Know,
we're
yeah,
taking
yeah.
care of the teaching.
Indeed,
you know?
I agree.
Yeah. The teaching for me, I would say the teaching for me was 10 to 12% of the college experience. Dominie, you have teenagers at home?
23-year-old and 11-year-old.
Okay. And how are they getting on, do you think?
They're grand. I mean, I think that people with younger children probably had a tougher time when schools were closed. And maybe teenagers, you know, I'm lucky both kids are of an age where it wasn't as impactful in a lot of ways. But I think, you know, the idea of schools closing, again, we know the damage that it does. And certainly, I think there's probably a lot of frustration, what with the hand sanitizer and so on, you know, this week. So hopefully it is brinksmanship, and there just needs to be that sort of attention and support given for teachers, because at the end of the day, it is brilliant that they've been able to remain open. And, you know, certainly the evidence shows that the risk of them opening up hasn't sort of manifested in this absolute explosion.
Obviously, some cases increase, but it
looks pretty good. And really, I think that's a huge benefit and something that everyone involved needs to be applauded for.
Let's take a break from this for a second. Gary, there's a poll in the Business Post today, and it's like politics is rumbling on here, party politics rumbling on too, maybe not in as obvious a way as it always is. Did you take anything out of the poll?
There's a consistency in the polls basically since the general election, and particularly over the course of the last 4 months or so. Fine Gael are up again to 37%. Of the first preference vote intention, Brendan.
The Teflon tarnished, they're calling Leo Varadkar.
Well, indeed. I mean, when we obviously saw his attack, or to use that word, on Neffeth on the Claire Byrne show a few weeks ago, he has moved on from that. I was interested to see he didn't go on Claire Byrne immediately after last Monday's announcement.
Even though he was apparently one of the people who became very, very pro-lockdown.
Yeah, I mean, in a very short space of time. But Fine Gael are, you know, they got 21% in the general election. I think the Taoiseach and then Taoiseach and leader Fine Gael bears a serious culpability for their poor performance. Sinn Féin are at 27%, and that's been steady now for four polls in a row in the Business Post. But again, this is pretty grim reading for Fianna Fáil, 11%, just up 1%. They got no post-budget bounce, Michael Brennan writing today in the Business Post. And then it's a sort of a long tail, Independents 8 to Greens at 6, holding steady as such, the Social Democrats, Labour at 3, and then it just tails away into the 2s and the 1. So the analysis that a lot of us would say is that Irish politics does seem to be fragmenting into a Fine Gael versus Sinn Féin view of the world. I know that there's a lot of people in Fianna Fáil who have been very critical of the Taoiseach, that and leader of Fianna Fáil, Micheál Martin, and still at 11%. This will give, I think, just to his critics.
So Fianna Fáil is the SDLP here in some sense.
Well, this is a great danger in one way, you know, that I know many in Fianna Fáil are worried about, that they will be colonised on the sort of centre-right and in government by Fine Gael, and colonised on the left and in their nationalist heritage. And this sort of shared history that Micheál Martin talked about during the week is, I think, important. They cannot leave that ground to Sinn Féin. But if I was in Fianna Fáil, you could clearly have to be worried at these figures. Now, what are we, 4 months into the government?
Yeah. No, but I guess this is all academic, because there's going to be no election, is there?
I wouldn't have thought so. You can run an election, clearly. We have seen elections run across the world. We're going to see a very important one on Tuesday week in the United States. So an election could be run, but there's no appetite, obviously, within the government for an election, given the fact that it's the 4 months it's been in office have been, to put it mildly, extraordinarily difficult for it, some of it self-inflicted and others of it obviously consumed by the virus.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, Dominic, you were looking at Eoin O'Malley has a very strong piece in the Sunday Independent today about George Lee. You mentioned earlier that there's a lot of doom and gloom in the news, and O'Malley says George Lee seems to be the pornographer in chief, but that that RTE is in the business of the pornography of the pandemic, etc. Do you think? I think some of his specifics are a bit unfair in terms of, like, he says George Lee ignores this, that and the other, which I think is a bit unfair. But do you think that's a view that is shared by people, that it's all gloom and doom?
Yeah, I do. And I think, again, when the figures are being reported, I think maybe more figures need to be reported and to look at it in its entirety. Because
well, they have taken now to putting in positivity rate, hospitalizations, everything. We just heard on the news there, hospitalizations down. That was reported on the news.
Yeah, I think when the focus is just on cases, I think people equate them with deaths. And I find that, you know, we hear statistics that up to 80, 85 people die every day in Ireland of all causes. So, again, it's this absolute focus on COVID. And we hear that apparently, you know, Ireland has now the strictest lockdown measures, that our media are obsessed with reporting all the doom and gloom. There are other things happening. There are other things going on. And certainly, I think the idea that NPHET, that certainly the article was suggesting that NPHET doesn't get challenged quite enough. And I think when you look at the size of the meetings that are held with NPHET, there's an awful lot of people, around 40 people at those meetings. I think it seems like there's a danger of groupthink. And certainly there are a growing number of medics that are discussing alternative ways to approach this. And I think those debates need to be had in a more open way. And really, the expertise that we have needs to be presented, and the government have to make those decisions. And it feels right now that the government are weak, and there's a little bit of dilly-dallying, and that they are going with the expert advice as opposed to making decisions as leaders. And I think that's part of the frustration. You need challenge, you need a robust debate. And unfortunately, the minute anything else is suggested, it is, you know, you're leaning left, you're leaning right. There's no middle ground. And I think that if we want social cohesion and good long-term approaches, we need to have those discussions.
But I think the point could be made, though, that the government is taking these decisions. I mean, we just referenced Leo Varadkar earlier on, who did disagree with NPHET a few weeks ago. So the government didn't go to level five. Well, maybe it should have, but it didn't. So it did take a decision there. And like my DCU colleague, Professor O'Malley, is very trenchant in his views that NPHET seems to be running the state or running the government. But an alternative picture could be painted that, you know, the government is actually taking decisions. It just might be the decisions that some people agree with.
Sarah Ann, I'm guessing that you would think let NPHET run the country right now.
No. I think that we listen to medical experts and then the government should govern. I suppose, should I bring COVID zero into the debate, or would that just throw the whole thing out? If we have a robust debate, I think, you know, which I think we do. And
I think we're robust debating till we're exhausted yes. from it. Like, and actually very interesting prime time during the week where there were a lot of diverse voices. Like John Lee, I think, from the UK, is a pathologist who was very compelling on his side of the argument. There was an interesting piece, guys, yesterday by Cliff Taylor.
Yeah.
Did you read that?
I did.
And he makes the point in it that in Northern Ireland, documents were published along with the announcement of restrictions there, drawn from UK government research on what contribution individual measures might have in terms of reducing the R naught, right? So basically, they looked at the economic cost of each measure. And then he's saying, like, we need database consideration on on the restrictions. Non-food retail, he claims, obviously a lot of people complaining here that the shops up in the north are opened. Non-food retail is seen in the documents published in the north as a lower impact measure in terms of reducing the virus, but one where closure comes with a high economic cost. So they're almost doing that balance that we are kind of we're told we're afraid to do, like, but they are doing that. Do we need to see that here, Dominie, do you reckon?
Yeah, I'd love to see more examples of the evidence upon which decisions are being made. And certainly, you know, I thought one of the interesting things in terms of one of the approaches that they've done in Sweden is that they quarantine if you test positive. You quarantine for a period of 5 to 7 days and then they test you again. Whereas there seems to be suggestions of quarantines for up to 14 days in other countries. And again, this probably means that people are more reluctant to go for testing because if it's positive and they have to quarantine for 14 days. So again, it's these pragmatic approaches to getting people to comply with the public health measures. And I think that has to be the balance. If you want people to adhere, it has to be sustainable and it has to be for long term, because certainly there are suggestions that a vaccine isn't going to be the panacea that we all think it is. So if we're going to be in this situation for a couple of years, we can't just keep locking down, opening up and locking down. So again, where's the evidence? What are we making the decisions on? Have really good, robust debates at those NPHET meetings, because certainly when you look at the minutes, it doesn't look like there's enough dissent or challenge within those meetings.
Do you torment yourself with reading all the minutes?
Yeah. And then torment my family by telling them all about it.
And so, your assessment is that there isn't robust discussion?
I think there's a lot of brilliant people in those rooms and who have a huge amount of expertise and experience, but I don't believe that there is enough debate and challenge within those meetings. Certainly when you read the minutes, it does not seem that way.
Okay, and look, they're not here, but that's your take on it anyway. Sarah-Ann, you mentioned zero COVID. See, a lot of people are starting to say to me that, God, the zero COVID is starting to look more attractive now as we realise what the alternatives are. Are you gone zero COVID yourself, Sarah-Ann?
No, I'm not. I am not a public health expert, which I think is important. And
listen, it's not holding anyone back today. We're all entitled to our own.
But you had a speaker on in May, I think, from UCC, a professor from UCC, and the reaction to his suggestion of zero COVID was visceral. I remember at the time, and yet, you know, we've gone through one lockdown. We've opened up possibly too quickly. We're back again. So I'm just saying we need to be open. I think one thing that's come through for me, I don't know how much we used to discuss public health or public health experts. I don't know if they, and we can see with the consultants at the moment, were they given the same support perhaps, or did they have? So I think that's been quite interesting for me, because public health in the UK and other countries is you know, gets a lot more attention. So I found that quite interesting.
Yeah, we're certainly realising that it's a fairly Cinderella
Clean,
part.
I think that was Jerry Clean.
I remember that day though. What the major panic he caused was, he suggested that cats were spreading coronavirus. And I'll tell you something, I've been here now most of this year and we have not had a reaction to anything. We clarified three times that the cats were not spreading the coronavirus because people were...
Can I just say, just on Cliff Taylor's piece, Brendan, I thought it was very interesting, the idea that we need to think in terms of what we can keep open, what we, as distinct from what, you know, what we can shut down quickly. And I think that, for instance, in terms of, we talked about sport earlier on, golf and tennis and whatnot. Maybe we should be switching our idea there. What can we keep open if we move levels to 4 and 5 as is currently the case? And I think that would be a better mind shift for people than the current situation.
Okay, I've got a very interesting call on all this now, right? Patrick Horne, you're a Mayo man and you're currently living in Melbourne. Are you there?
I am indeed.
Hi, Patrick. So, Patrick, we're looking to you for a bit of hope, I suppose. I don't know if you've been listening, but I think we've hit a dead end in looking for answers here. So I know Melbourne has had one of the longest and a very, very strict lockdown, but I think it's getting you the results now and you're at the early stages of getting back to normal. Would that be right?
That's correct, yeah. So early July, I think, was the first initial lockdown, which I think I was due to talk to yourself then, which was the week that Jack Charlton passed away, which might give people a sense of how long ago that is. So initially, that was brought in, with the messaging being that we had too many unknown cases. There was only about 200 cases a day at the time, but it was a lot of mystery cases. So
Patrick, I'll interrupt you there for a second. I'm going to try and see if we can fix that line, because I would love to hear what you have to say, but we can't hear it very well at the moment. So I'm going to take a break, sure. and we'll see how we can sort that out. So Gary Murphy, Dominic Kemp and Sarah Ann Buckley still with us, and just bear with us for a few minutes, because this is very interesting.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Okay, welcome back. Our panel, Gary Murphy, Dominic Kemp and Sarah Ann Buckley, are still with us. And I'm going to try and go back to Patrick Horn in Melbourne now. Patrick, are you there?
Indeed.
So, Patrick, where is your life at right now in Melbourne in terms of getting back to normal?
So we're effectively locked in. Some easing restrictions in recent weeks. We need to get the case down, numbers down to single figures, and our day average now is below 5, which was the magic number that we were told on, but we got to that number, we were able to lift restrictions. So people are getting a bit antsy now. We've had a few limited restrictions. We've had some limited restrictions lift, but we are kind of coming to that stage now where people are wondering when we can actually get out of it and get back to some sort of normality. But the hope is definitely there. The numbers, the lockdown certainly worked in terms of bringing those case numbers down.
Okay. How hard was the lockdown in terms of, there's a lot of talk here as we head into another one about mood, mental health, people's resilience for this. Yours, obviously, the latest lockdown goes back to the 1st of August, am I right? How did people bear up mentally?
Yeah, even early July, I think, was the initial one, and then the tough one came in August. So it's been hard, and there's definitely been a lot of pushback and a lot of opposition to the lockdown measures on the basis that people are doing it tough. But I guess since the numbers have been going down since it was implemented, there has been that sense that we're sort of pulling towards a common goal, if you like. But and I think in Melbourne, really, people are generally compliant. They like to follow the rules, and we were in the winter here as well, so it wasn't that people weren't as inclined to be outside. So I think there was a sense of batting down the hatches a bit. And I think the majority of people, once the numbers started to go up initially, which was caused by a bit of a debacle in terms of how they managed the hotel quarantine, the returned overseas travellers, once the numbers started to get up and out of control, there was definitely majority support for bringing in the initial lockdown. And then as the numbers start to go down, they managed to sort of maintain that support, if you like.
But there was a hefty fine system, wasn't there? And like police drones around watching people.
There was. So the government introduced emergency powers in order to be able to fine people for not wearing masks, for having gatherings and so on and so forth. So they were able to implement it fairly strictly, yeah.
And you think that closing borders was a huge element to this?
Massively, yeah. So Australia closed its national borders way back at the start of this and obviously haven't reopened since. And then even within Australia, so Victoria, which is the state that Melbourne is in, we've been restricted from travelling to any other state. So we can't go to Sydney or Adelaide or anywhere like that. So states have been very quick to bring in those measures, and the rest of Australia hasn't really been hit with even a first wave at this stage. I think Melbourne is responsible or has about 800 deaths at this stage, which is about 90% of Australia's total. There's been very little in the way of case numbers and deaths in the rest of the country. So Victoria has essentially been quarantined from the rest of the country.
Yeah. Are the schools back open?
They have been open just the last couple of weeks or so. So we've seen that, and that's definitely a source of relief for a lot of people. I don't have kids myself, but no colleagues in work. They were certainly very pleased to see that happen. And we also saw some single bubbles being introduced as well to address the mental health concerns. There was a sense that people were really struggling, not being able to have people come around to the house. So there's been a few liftings along the way to acknowledge that.
Okay. How did the contact tracing system bear up?
So that's been another source of controversy, in the sense that people think that we should be able to open up to some extent, and the government has been very clear that bringing an eradication strategy, that they are trying to suppress it to the level that they can then maintain the outbreaks that do happen and the clusters that do happen.
Okay.
But there's been a lot of pressure on that system, and there's a real sense that now that we're not being let out of it as quickly as we thought we might be, have they really got their ducks in a row in that regard?
Okay, listen, Patrick, I'll let you go there. So thanks a million. That was really interesting, and I suppose a bit of light at the end of the tunnel for us. Gary, Tomás Ryan, conjures an extraordinary picture at the start of he's advocating for zero COVID, as he does in the Sunday Business Post. But he says at the start that, was it the All Blacks played Australia or somebody yesterday anyway in Auckland, and there were 50,000 people
full
at
house,
the match.
Yeah, and it's extraordinary to watch in Australia. They had supporters at the at the AFL, you know, they're equivalent of the All-Ireland, now reduced number certainly, but we won't have any supporters at our own All-Ireland series beginning this weekend. And it's heartbreaking. I remember I went to Old Trafford in February with my son just before the lockdown, and we were watching United perform miserably again yesterday in front of an empty house. It's terrible to see. I mean, the issue, though, in terms of Professor Ryan's piece, COVID-free, while I think all of us would like to see it, does seem to be a very long way away. And the measures needed to achieve it, I think, would be unsustainable. If we see people revolting against level five, as they seem to be, particularly in rural Ireland, as in some of the papers today, I just don't think it's public or politically feasible.
But how many do we, like, you question then, is this our best alternative? Like, because at the moment we're locked down anyway, but with no clear way out of it for, say, your industry. Would you like to see zero COVID, which I see Danielle Byrne talks to a zero COVID advocate today in the Sunday Business Post, and it's summed up as, you get your life back, you just can't travel.
And it sounds great. I see so many scientists saying it's just not possible and that this is going to be something that's going to be around for a long time. And as a result, we've got to get better at treating it. We've got to get better with our hospitals, with our capacity, better with the social distancing, better with public health measures, and accept it's going to be around. It seems that New Zealand, they got rid of it and then it comes back again. Unless the whole world locks down, there's no international travel. I don't see how you can remain COVID-free.
Yeah, you see, they will argue that zero COVID advocates will argue there are over a billion people in the world now living effectively in a zero COVID world, and that other countries that are zero COVID, we can all, you know, mix it up with each other. But yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, the cases are on the rise across Europe. I mean,
they sure are. We're in the halfpenny place next to the rest of Europe.
Yeah, and some of the difficulties we have here, we saw the difficulty with the HSC in terms of tracing, are happening in Europe as well. So we're not alone, but it's, I didn't think 8 months later we would still be.
But we're sometimes in a bit of a no man's land because there isn't a lot of people travelling now. So we're not getting that privilege.
Exactly.
And yet we are going through this seesaw. So I'm just wondering, has it been fully debated and explored, zero COVID? And I am not an economist either, but it would be good to see some modelling for, if we're still in this position in 10 months' time, what will have been the effect? So I think it has to be part of the debate.
And I think one of the other issues, Ciara Kelly's piece today in the Sunday Independent talks about a vaccine not being a panacea for COVID, with for a few reasons. One, in relation to those who are anti-vax anyway. The other is in relation to its success rate. I think she mentions 70%. So in other vaccines, notwithstanding what a COVID vaccine would look like. So, I mean, those of us who thought that the vaccine would be this panacea, I mean, I was certainly struck reading that this morning that it wasn't, and that was a bit grim, I thought.
And how long immunity will last, with the vaccine. So I think that zero COVID just has to become more and more part of the debate.
Okay, now, another big part of the debate in Ireland this week was the mother and baby homes, the sealing of the files from the Commission of Inquiry and the legislation around it and everything else. I think for a lot of people, this is quite a complicated story. Sarah, and this is kind of your area, obviously, and you've been very involved in Tuam and all that. Could you explain to us in terms that people will understand, what is the problem here?
Well, I think to start by saying that on a positive level, the hashtag Repeal the Seal and other campaigns have shown how much this is important to the public. How often do we see petitions with almost 130,000, 140,000 signatures in 2 days? I think it is very complicated. This particular bill, there's two things. There's what the bill says and contains and what the bill doesn't say. And I think, first of all, how the minister brought this about has to be discussed. It was rushed. There was no pre-legislative scrutiny. As we saw, there was a refusal to allow amendments, and there's a lot of clarification that was needed. The question of sealing, which has been a big part of this discussion, this particular bill doesn't seal the archive. It's the pre-existing legislation, but it's government policy that they are saying the 2004 Act will seal the archive.
No. Can I just stop you there?
Yes.
So the people's understanding of this will be that they're taking out, the minister is trying to do the right thing in some way here, isn't he, by taking out specific files from that seal and giving them to Tuzla. And this is specific information about women who were taken into those places, dates of birth of babies, etc. That would be helpful to people who are trying to trace their own identity and their history, wouldn't it? And he's taking that out of the seal.
It's not at all going far enough.
Okay.
That's the point.
What is the information that is going to be sealed then? That would, I'm sorry if it's coming across being stupid here, but just so that we're clear on this. What is going into the 30-year seal that people would want access to?
Everything is. So their own personal files. The problem is the database is great, okay? Database is great. It is to be welcomed. But GDPR in 2018 should already mean that people can get access to their personal files. OK, so that is what campaigners, survivors, activists,
so are
academics
people's personal
are
files being sealed in this 30-year seal? Or what
no,
I understood
being,
was these were the stories that people told is what's being is the rest
their
of that report.
Testimonies, they will be allowed to apply to the minister for them. This archive
for their own testimony.
Their own testimony. One of the problems here
and
is
their
and
testimony
I'm not
will be anonymized in the report as well. Yes, it'll be there.
Yeah. But
so what is going? You see, I'm sorry.
I'll try.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Do you get my point? Like that?
I get
what
your
I don't
point.
Get,
if
yeah.
I can just run through and I understand it is complicated. Okay. The commission's report will be 4,000 pages long, as the minister has said. He has said it will have an index. As a historian, one of the issues is the minister has even admitted he's not sure what's in that archive in regards to private records, public records. OK, this is a very important point. Secondly, in 2018, GDPR should, as the Data Protection Commissioner has said, supersede the 2004 Act, and people should have access to their personal. So that can be many records, Brendan. It could be one person's story may run through a number of institutions. They may need a number of different types of records, not just their testimony that they gave, but any records in the archive that is applicable to them. Now,
so
I'm
there will be records in the archive that will not, that will go into the seal.
We don't know what's in the archive.
Yeah,
We've asked the minister, Breed Smith asked the minister in the Dáil what's in the archive. He has said the index will be published. He has said, and that's fine, but we have asked for clarification. And in my opinion, as a historian, I need to know, will the private records of religious orders and other organisations, will that be one line that says 70 years, or will there be specific lists of what records are there?
And Sarah-Ann, is this a broader issue that was pre-existing here about basically people's right to find out who they were and the conflicting right then of privacy that there was in this country for maybe mothers and different people? Is that what this is boiling down to again?
Well, in one way, it's regretful that this debate has come about the way it has. People have been debating this since 2004. This was not a new issue for the government. They should have foreseen this reaction. There have been many groups that have tried to weigh in and help. Unfortunately, I don't believe the minister has met the collaborative forum. So some of this was about the way in which this bill was proposed. But now there is a lot more attention to the fact that these commissions and previous commissions, we have to remember, last year we were at this exact time discussing the retention of records bill, which was the SICA or the Ryan Commission's archive, and that legislation was talking about a 75-year seal. These debates are ongoing.
Okay.
I think what's good about this week is, and the minister has acknowledged, that there is a huge sense of injustice here. Survivors are very articulate. They have been coming forward, as have survivor groups. That's incredibly positive, I think, and we need to take that positive from it. And I guess we just need to look forward to the consultation and collaboration that has been mentioned.
Yes.
But it was a bad week, in my opinion, for the government on this issue.
Okay. Gary, there seems to be general agreement, is there, that the minister should perhaps have... No, he says he didn't want to delay the report any further. Is there general agreement that he should have maybe paused and listened more to the people who... These are people, like, who have carried a huge hurt all their lives. Like, and I think a lot of them feeling triggered again by this and feeling it's brought it all back again.
Indeed, I do think there is that widespread view. Now, first of all, I must say I know the minister. I actually hired him to DCU back in 2012. I haven't spoken to him on this issue at all. But I do know him to be a man of a very incredible, I think, social conscience. I think he is a good person, and I think his heart is in the right place. But I think politically he has made a number of mistakes, and I think one of them is the insistence on getting this report out. You know, we've waited an awful long time, as Sarah Ann has said. We could wait certainly somewhat longer. Now, he's taken a lot of grief about the Attorney General's view on this, on the 2004 Act. And in one way, I do have some sympathy for him. Attorney Generals are there to provide advice. Now, many of my colleagues in academia would say, well, that's all it is to provide advice. But, like, governments are very loath to go against Attorney General's advice because inevitably it could come back to haunt them. I also think politically the minister made a mistake by not accepting any amendments from the opposition benches. It did hark back to this sort of system of we're the government and we know best, as distinct from taking a wider parliamentary view of the feelings within the within the Dáil. I agree with Sarah Ann pretty much in everything. We want these the records open. I don't think the minister is trying to hide the records, but I do think he hasn't handled it as well as he could, and he's admitted that himself. The 30-year rule is interesting. I mean, Sarah Ann would know better than anyone else. We could reduce that to 20 years. It's 20 in Britain, well, I think, isn't it, Sarah Ann?
So the National Archives Act now, it is 20 years.
Yeah.
So this legislation also, there are records in, I guess one thing I will say is, there is records in this digitised archive that the minister's department will have, which are already available. And for me, there's an opportunity for the minister that the administrative records, the records on the running of the system, they could be made available.
Okay, and they are not, the proposal is at the moment that they will not be made available, those records.
Government policy,
you think?
Yes, is that this is going to be, yes.
Okay.
Just to finish, but I do think there is a case for the minister to meet with historians like Sarah Ann and Maeve O'Rourke and others, you know, who again in good conscience are bringing up the difficulties as they see it with him. But I do know
is the idea of 30 years that people
and conscious of what's happened this week.
Is the idea of 30 years that people would be dead?
But no, 30 years in 2004 was the National Archives Act, so that's 30 years was...
And the idea is that the heat is taken
distance,
out of something.
Like,
there's a distance, okay. Sarah Ann, would you be able to tell me, like, kind of briefly and succinctly, for these people, what needs to happen now for these people who've been so upset by this and clearly have been carrying such an awful upset all their lives?
I think, first of all, I would never speak on behalf of survivors. They're well able to.
I know, but we don't have a survivor here. Is someone familiar with the situation?
What has been called for is that the archive not be sealed. So I think that the government policy needs to look at this question of making records available. Step one does need to be survivors' personal data and records. Okay. It would be good if perhaps the government published the data protection impact assessment from the Data Protection and Commissioner, and if there was a lot more clarification. I understand the Attorney General's advice. I suppose some legal academics have said it isn't actually binding, it is advice. And a year ago, the advice on retention of records was also 75-year seal. So I think we need to, you know, have a discussion around that. But for survivors, it's about that this becomes survivor-led and they are consulted more and more.
Okay. Thanks, Sarah Ann. Dominic Kemp and Gary Murphy still with us too. We're going to take a break. We're going to find out after the break what the latest is about schools, okay?
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Wayne O'Connor of the Sunday Independent, good morning.
Good morning, Brendan. How are you?
Good. Are the schools going to open up again after midterm break?
I think the schools will open up after midterm, but I think the issue there afterwards is staying open for teachers. A lot of the principals are concerned, I suppose, about being isolated somewhat by the HSE, difficulties getting in contact with contact tracing teams and public health experts who can help them and give them guidance when there is an outbreak or a positive case in a school. Essentially, what they're saying is that unless they get greater support and unless there's more help there for them, it's going to be difficult. It's interesting as well that the ASTI are out this morning as well, and they're questioning whether the safety measures that were put in place for schools in August are still appropriate, given the context of where we are now
with
level 5
transmission, etc.
Okay.
So look, it's kind of the ball is in the HSE court now, and they've got a week to make the teachers happy. Is that roughly what we're saying?
That's roughly it, yeah. And it's essentially, I suppose, what the teachers want is they want dedicated phone lines, dedicated teams who are going to be there to support the schools, help keep the schools open and help deal with cases as they arise in schools.
Yeah, which seems
there's going to be talks later in the week about that, I think. And the Department of Education and the HSE seem to be working towards something along those lines anyway.
Okay, and look, look on the face of it, that sounds reasonable enough. Okay, Wayne, thanks very much.
Thanks, Brendan.
Guys, before we go, shops is kicking around as a big issue. We saw a guy go crazy in Wales and attack one of the sealed off non-essential aisles of stuff. Sports Direct is open in Ireland selling essential goods. Like, I hear somebody was telling me a story of they went up to some town in Cavan and the local shoe shop was open because they were selling boots. There was a clothes shop open because it was selling Hi-Vis, and the gift shop was open because they had hand sanitizer. Dominic, what do you make of this essential, non-essential demarcation with shops? It's getting messy, isn't it?
It is, but you know what? I really don't begrudge any business for trying to find a way to stay open. And look, that's what entrepreneurs do, is they will try and climb over every obstacle to keep their business open. But, you know, look, I think retail has in general been very, very safe. It's been really well controlled. You know, the supermarkets have remained open the whole time. We haven't seen
very low real cases issues among people
exactly
working in supermarkets.
And, you know, they're pretty crowded and they can get busy at times. So I think, look, hopefully businesses, you know, will get a shot at Christmas and we won't see this mass stampede. People have certainly pivoted to online sales and so on. And I'm sure retail will adapt in terms of maybe longer opening hours, more shopping by appointment, etc. But I do think there's definitely been some bending the rules. But you know what? That's what business people do.
Yeah. Listen, there's a texter here saying, I've tried to shop local. You know, the way we've all been told, shop local. And if you go online. I simply cannot afford the difference in prices in my local shops compared to online prices. We're talking €10 difference for a small toy, €17 for another one, €50 on an electrical item, €7 in a book. Like, with the best will in the world, we do want to support our indigenous businesses, but they probably have to shape up a bit. Do they, Dominic, in terms of...
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky, though, when you're competing against the Goliath that is Amazon, etc. So, you know, different rents, different rates and so on. That's always going to be the problem. But, I mean, I think there's been a huge surge online in terms of people saying we need to support Irish, support local and stuff. And that is brilliant to see.
But then, of course, the people who've lost their jobs and, you know, who are on the PUP, I mean, every penny counts and it's difficult, you know. I have great sympathy with the texter because price certainly matters.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, listen, Gary Murphy, Dominic Kemp and Sarah Ann Buckley, thank you very much for that. And now, just coming up to noon, let's go to the newsroom.